This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Nigeria's military said on Wednesday that it has rescued one of the 219 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram militants from the northeastern town of Chibok over 2 years ago. She is the first girl to be found since the mass kidnapping.
That's Chris Stein with the latest on the rescue. His report coming up next.
Also, the first Italy-Africa ministerial conference opened today in Rome with over 50 African countries, the UN and high-ranking Italian officials represented, and the Women Deliver conference continues in Copenhagen.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Nigeria's military said today that it has rescued one of the 219 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram militants from the northeastern town of Chibok over 2 years ago. She is the first girl to be found since the mass kidnapping. Chris Stein has more from Lagos.
The circumstances of the girl's rescue are unclear. Army spokesman Sani Usman said in a text message that the girl was found in the village of Bale, near the northeast Nigerian town of Damboa. A vigilante leader in Chibok, Aboku Gaji, told VOA vigilantes found her while setting up an ambush near a Boko Haram camp.
As we lie ambush, they come just come on us.
Gaji identified the girl as Amina Ali, while the army gave her name as Falmata Balala. Gaji said the rescued girl had a baby with her. She was also with her husband, a fellow Boko Haram captive she had married while in captivity. Gaji said the girl was identified by her mother, then handed over to the military. Boko Haram abducted the 219 schoolgirls in April 2014 from their dormitory at the government secondary school in Chibok. Protesters took to the streets in Nigeria and around the world, imploring the government to bring back our girls. Outside of videos released by the Islamist insurgents, none of the girls had been seen again, until today. The chairman of the Chibok Elders Forum, Pogo Baitris, said he was elated by the rescue.
At least they are alive, they are being found, and whatever situation or condition, that doesn't matter. The important thing is they are alive and they are being found.
Gaji said the rescued girl confirmed what has long been suspected, that Boko Haram was holding the abductees in their stronghold in the Sambisa forest.
She told us that the other girls were still there in the Sambisa.
Gaji said the girl told him six of her abducted classmates had died in captivity. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Kenyan police are coming under fire for their brutal response to an opposition protest Monday. Lenny Ruvaga reports for VOA from Nairobi. Photos and video of police beating protesters have sparked outrage.
3 Mondays in a row, Kenya's main opposition coalition has demonstrated at the Electoral Commission in Nairobi, calling for it to be disbanded before next year's polls. Each time, riot police dispersed protesters with tear gas and water cannons. But this week, police kicked and clubbed protesters as they ran, according to photos and videos posted online. Those include images of an officer stomping on an unconscious man's head. The man survived, but Kenyans have taken to Twitter to react with the hashtag #StopPoliceBrutality. Nairobi Governor Evans Kidero called for swift action.
We've said that the Police Oversight Authority must investigate this, and the people who meted out violence against innocent people who were engaging in peaceful protest must be prosecuted.
This is not the first time the police have been accused of abuses. The Independent Medical Legal Unit, IMLU, released a study late last year that found police were responsible for nearly 300 gun-related killings since the start of 2014. Executive Director of the Kenya Human Rights Commission, KHRC, George Kegoro, says excessive use of force cannot be tolerated.
We would like to get assurances from the police department that as the country heads towards elections, and the mobilization of large crowds happen, this is not going to be the kind of response that we see from the police department. So we must celebrate and preserve the rights of citizens to protest.
The Independent Policing Oversight Authority, IPOA, is looking into Monday's violence, according to board member Tom Kagwe.
Already investigations have been launched, and we will see which officers was culpable. If we can't find the particular individual who is culpable, we will file a case with the highest responsibility in line of command.
The Inspector General of Police has also ordered an investigation, though activists say similar orders in recent years have yielded little action or reform. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
The first Italy-Africa ministerial conference opened today in Rome. Among those attending are representatives of over 50 African countries, the UN, and high-ranking Italian officials. They include President Sergio Mattarella, who opened the plenary session, and Italy's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Paolo Gentiloni. They're discussing ways of ending the influx of hundreds of thousands of migrants into the European Union each year from Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia. Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi is seeking approval of his migration compact. It aims to provide EU financial incentives to African countries to boost development and deter migration. Reporter Josephine McKenna is in Rome covering the conference. She spoke with me about the significance of this event.
Well, this conference was organized by the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and it brings together over 40 African ministers from different countries, of course, and the Prime Minister of Italy, Matteo Renzi, plus the President of Italy, Sergio Mattarella. It's a one-day conference. There are also members of the African Union here, and it's designed to discuss opportunities for sustainable growth in Africa, as well as addressing key issues related to immigration and climate change. The Italian Foreign Minister, Paolo Gentiloni, told the conference that it was impossible to exclude the possibility of new migrant emergencies in the future. And the Italian government, of course, is very concerned about the growing number of immigrants who are making the perilous crossing across the Mediterranean. And recently we've seen a surge with the closure of the Balkan route. This year there have been more than 30,000 arrivals from the north coast of Africa across the Mediterranean, landing on the shores of Italy.
Also, he is calling on the AU to make a commitment or a pact with them to prevent central Mediterranean, that route, from flaring up in the coming months. So what has been the AU's response?
Well, the Italian government put a proposal to the European Union saying that there should be more investment in Africa to encourage those economies, to promote those economies, encourage people to stay at home instead of immigrating to Europe. That requires additional funding from Europe, and at the moment the EU has given conditional support, but there doesn't seem to be a resolve on how that will be financed. That is something that resonates with the African countries. Today we saw a presentation from the International Fund for Agricultural Development, the United Nations organization, talking about the importance of rural development and investing in communities, particularly to reduce the impact of climate change and migration.
What do you think the outcome of this conference is going to be at the end of the day?
I think the Italian government wants to promote greater dialogue. There are representatives here from the United Nations and the African Union trying to build relationships, support each other with greater economic investment, and ensure that more people remain in Africa, in North Africa, and have a future of some kind to try and curtail any future wave of immigration that we're likely to see in the coming months across the Mediterranean. That seems like an ambitious goal at the moment, because we are seeing a surge of people arriving and growing tension too inside Italy. Yesterday, day there was a fire in one of the migrant centres in Lampedusa in Sicily, as there are concerns about overcrowding and where this is going to go in the future if people continue to arrive in Italy.
Can you tell us more about the tension down in Lampedusa and what is being done to try to curb that?
Late Tuesday, a group of migrants set fire to a shelter on the island of Lampedusa. There were no injuries, but it is an indication of the increasing tension in Italy's packed migrant centres. One building was set ablaze. There were no injuries, but this is an indication of just how tense things are. In the past 2 years, more than 320,000 immigrants have arrived by sea on Italian shores. And this year we've had more than 30,000 arrivals. So Italian shelters are bursting at the seams, and there's concern that there won't be enough accommodation if more immigrants continue to arrive.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with me from the first ever Italy-Africa Ministerial Conference in Rome. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Nigeria's military said today that it has rescued one of the 219 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram militants from the northeastern town of Chibok over 2 years ago. Kenyan police are coming under fire for their brutal response to an opposition protest on Monday. And the first Italy-Africa Ministerial Conference to open today in Rome, with over 50 African countries, the UN, and high-ranking Italian officials represented. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
It's day three of the Women Deliver Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark. It's the world's largest gathering devoted to the well-being and empowerment of women and girls. For the third part of our series with headliners at the conference, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Townsend of the Population Council. It's a Washington-based NGO dedicated to women's health. Townsend says women's health has actually improved overall during the past quarter century when world attention began to focus more on women.
In general, I would say women are probably healthier now. There's fewer deaths from pregnancy or delivery complications. There are HIV prevention treatments and care is much more widespread than it was in the early 90s. People are living longer. At the same time, I think women are subject to a diverse set of circumstances. Women who are living in war zones, or women in areas that are affected by drought, women in areas that are affected by infectious diseases. They are the caregivers in the front line for almost all development efforts, making their life more stressful and certainly challenging.
You could have probably said the same thing at any point in time. I mean, is there a worsening that's particular to this historical moment, would you say?
I think in some ways people know about it more. These are public events, not private suffering. We know about sexual and gender-based violence. We know about HIV. I think the difference is people are beginning to say enough.
What are you really excited about in this conference? What do you hope to take away from this personally?
What I'm really excited about is the potential for hope among African youth. We spend a lot of focus on women and girls, but young boys also need opportunities. They will be the partners of those young girls later, and they have to understand, I think, both the benefits and the responsibility that comes with gender equality. Women and girls clearly are at the center. They're also part of families and communities. And so what our role is to create spaces for them where spaces have been denied. Give them the opportunity to ask about accountability of public officials. Women have the right to care, to health, and I think the Women Deliver event is one in which those aspirations will be shared, debated, critiqued, and I would hope implemented.
I'm sure that you butt up against a lot of cultural and also social, not to mention sort of hardwired biological resistance to the idea of limiting the size of your family or planning it too much. I mean, tell me a little bit about how you approach those kind of cultural resistances and encourage people to think in terms of planning, especially girls and women.
I don't want to overstate those obstacles. What we found, I think, in recent years, as we talk to parents about the aspirations for their children, particularly their girls, is that they want the best for them. They want to delay the girl's marriage so they can go to school or they can get a job. Fathers are now carrying girl children for vaccination, where you wouldn't see that a number of years ago. This is a different time. And I think we have to take advantage of that and not be detained by kind of traditional forces, but also that the governments contribute financially to that process. Reproductive health, including family planning and birthing services, was greatly underfinanced for such a long time. And I think we also understand that there's a stream of benefits that go to governments and communities by ensuring that families have the opportunity to remain healthy. They use the health services less. They contribute more on a consistent basis to the economy. They lend their ideas, leadership, their motivation and energy to development. There's a clear expression that investing in these areas will pay off for the economy as well as for the families who no longer will have to bury their wives and children prematurely.
That was John Townsend, Director of Reproductive Health for the Washington, D.C.-based Population Council, and one of those attending the Women Deliver Conference in Copenhagen. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
Not all countries are affected equally when it comes to climate change. In fact, scientists say rich nations probably will fare better than poor nations in some ways, and it's not just about the money. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
In climate change, as in business, it's location, location, location. And some very poor nations apparently are at the wrong latitudes when it comes to the impact of rising global temperatures. A team of international researchers says those countries are likely to experience heat extremes sooner than wealthy nations. Dr. Manoj Joshi is a senior lecturer at the University of East Anglia's School of Environmental Sciences in Britain.
There's an emerging field people have started looking at in the last few years related to climate change, which is called times of emergence. And it's not how much the world warms, but how fast it warms and how much that warming is related to the natural variation in climate from year to year.
He says the location of many wealthy nations allows greater variability in temperatures from year to year because they're not tropical countries. They're located in what are called the extratropics. In a sense, more natural variability in their weather offers some protection from heat extremes.
The exotropics, where a lot of the richest countries of the world lie, the climate signal is large, but the variability, what we call the year-to-year variation, is also large. So paradoxically, a lot of countries in the tropics, even though they warm more slowly, they will get more significant temperature rises quicker.
Joshi says if daily temperatures remain fairly steady in tropical countries from day to day and then year to year, people do not learn to adapt to extremes.
So if the variation is low, then any sort of change on top of that will be an extreme event because you're adapted to less variability.
He says countries in the Horn of Africa and West Africa are likely to be among the worst affected by heat extremes.
We're talking about tropical countries, those nearer the equator. And what it means is these countries will experience extreme temperatures earlier than we'll experience extreme temperatures. Sooner than we will, at a lower level of carbon dioxide, at a lower level of what's called in this paper cumulative emissions, when we add up the total amount of CO2 that all of us are putting into the atmosphere.
And ironically, poor countries, expected to see heat extremes sooner than rich nations, actually produce much less carbon dioxide emissions.
Yeah, that's certainly very interesting. It's just a way of how the climate system plays out, essentially. It's a consequence of that. The climate system responds in terms of the laws of physics. So it's not a question of fair or unfair. It's what the climate system is doing.
Drought is plaguing regions of the Horn of Africa, creating insecurity for many thousands of people. But Joshi says you have to be careful connecting that directly to climate change.
There's a drought going on in parts of the Horn of Africa, but some of that could be related to anomalous temperatures in the Indian Ocean or the El Nino that's been going on for the past 6 months to a year. So we have to be very careful attributing specific events to climate change rather than variability. But the sorts of extreme temperatures that we're talking about, they might start happening sooner in these sorts of countries.
Researchers say it's not clear whether efforts to limit CO2 emissions during the rest of this century will do anything to lessen the impact on poor countries. But they say the information may be used to help countries adapt to climate change. The findings are published in Environmental Research Letters. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
For the first time in 7 years, a large-scale clinical trial of an HIV vaccine candidate will be conducted. The four-year trial called HVTN-702 is scheduled to begin in November. Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says it will determine whether the vaccine is safe, tolerable, and effective in preventing HIV infection. The clinical trial is a follow-up to the 2009 trial done in Thailand that was found to be 31% effective in preventing infection. The new trial, which actually combines two experimental vaccines, will attempt to greatly improve on that. It's been adapted to an HIV strain that's widespread in southern Africa. Today's announcement was made on HIV Vaccine Awareness Day.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss whether there's a need for a fundamental change in U.S.-Africa relations. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss U.S.-Africa relations next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one I judge. This one I judge.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent, old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this
nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever.
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.